Well, g'day guys. Welcome to Talking Luft. I'm Mitch Docker. This is Life in the Peloton, and the podcast this year is being brought to you by our partners, MAP. Loving working with these guys over at the podcast, but also outside as well. We have got a special episode for you guys this week, Milan San Remo's most influential top six. This is a new idea that we're trying over here at Talking Luft. Well, I just thought it'd be fun to do because San Remo is around the corner, and I'm going to be chatting with Dave McKenzie to unpack the race, the top six. This is a special idea. It's fun. It's really fun. I really love the idea, and we have a lot of fun in the podcast in all Talking Luft style. The podcast is also being brought to you by Pillar. And Pillar is a sports micronutrition company that started in Australia, developing products that intersect between pharmaceutical intervention and sports supplements for athletes. What I mean by this is electrolytes and carbohydrates, those things, they're the things that help us get to the finish line. Pillar's mission is to get athletes to the start line in the best condition over and over again. So what I mean by that is I'm using Pillar's triple magnesium, and it's really changed my sleep. And in a good way, I'm talking about. How do I know? Because I'm not wearing sleep devices anymore. But what I notice is when I take the triple magnesium is that I drop into a really deep sleep. I wake up like I've been in a slumber, but very quickly, I feel alert and awake like I've had a deep sleep. If you're wearing sleep devices, you're going to be able to track that and notice what I'm talking about. You don't need to take my word for it, but you can feel it. You can definitely feel it when you have it and also when you don't have it. I've been taking it about 30 minutes before bed each night, and I like to prioritize my sleep not only for my physical body, but also for my mind and my emotional body. If you would like to try Pillar today, head over to pillarperformance.shop and use the code LITP for 15% off your first order, or for the USA listeners, head across to thefeed.com/pillar. Check it out, guys. This is a no-brainer. Good sleep, good recovery. It's really simple, and the triple magnesium does it all for you. No tricks about it. Well, guys, I'm going to keep it short and sharp this time. Sit back and enjoy San Remo's most influential top six. Well, we've got something different for you this week. This is a brand new idea. I don't know how I came up with it, but this is a new series. This is Talking Luft's top six most influential. And I'm joined by a special guest, Dave McKenzie. He rode professional for about 9 years, many moons ago. He even wrapped up a stage of the Giro d'Italia back in 2000. But more importantly, in recent years, he's been a commentator. He's a voice we know. That's why I thought he'd be perfect for this podcast. A nice, comfortable voice. Everyone knows his voice. Plus, he knows the game. Macca, welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much, mate. And look, I feel very honoured. You've come up with a new idea and you bring in the big guns, or the not so big guns. Look, pro for 9 years, I've actually been longer a commentator. Isn't that sad? I mean, it feels like yesterday I was still racing my bike, but actually I've been a commentator longer than I was a pro. So, but no, good to be here, mate.
Well, let's talk about this little idea. And we haven't really, we haven't really worked it out yet, have we? We've sort of talked about this idea, most influential. I'm going to throw it out there. San Remo's around the corner. It's such a big race. It sets up the year, I think. It's the first big one, the first monument. And I thought it'd be cool to discuss the most influential of San Remo, of the race. San Remo's most influential, top six. Why top six? You're probably asking. Well, I thought,
yes.
I thought top five, you know, that's sort of a good number. And then just throw in like just a roughie, like a number six, you know, just one that can be really debatable.
Yeah, I know what it was. Originally you thought three, and then you went, oh no, but there's five really special moments. And then you went, oh no, there's that sixth one as well. So, but hey, when you own the podcast, that's what you can do, mate. You can make up any random number and the listener has to go with it. So come on, let's dive in.
All right. Well, I guess there's got to be something around it. I think most influential, I reckon it's got to be around, it doesn't necessarily be, in my opinion, a race winner. San Remo is such a good race. Let's set up exactly what San Remo is. You know, San Remo is very old. It's from 1907. They call it La Classicissima. Is that correct? Yeah.
La classicissima. My Italian's a bit ropey these days, but yeah, it is like that. La primavera. Probably la primavera, firstly, because it's spring. It's the first monument of the year. You know, it really is. Even though the season's been going, this is it. This is the big one where, you know, all the cycling fans crawl out from under their rock. You know, if they don't want to watch Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, it's a little bit chilly. You know, generally Milan-San Remo, it's not warm, but it's not freezing cold. Although they have had one in the snow, or a couple in the snow, haven't they?
Well, back in the day, I'm assuming they probably had some too, but we don't even know about that. We just sort of only hear about the ones that we have witnessed. But they also call it, like, you know, the Sprinter's Classic, I guess, because later in the year they've got the Autumn Classic, which is the Climber's Classic, the Giro della Lombardia. I don't know, like the race is sort of set up with a long, it's very long. Yeah, we haven't mentioned that. It's 298K or 297 or 300. It's always around about there. It's the longest one-day race in modern cycling. I rode it a couple of times. I think there's something weird about it. I always had this like real obsession about the Cobble Classics, but there's something about San Remo. I don't know what it is. It's just that length, but there's something about that everyone can win it. You know, a sprinter can win it, but also we've seen climbers win it. And then I think that's probably why we need to discuss our top five.
I think so, top six, so top five and, you know, one for good measure. I think so. Well, do you want me to go first as a guest, or, you know, how does this work?
We'll crack into it.
Because we haven't, disclaimer, we haven't told each other, for the listener, we haven't told each other what our top six is. So this is could be completely random here.
It could be exactly aligned. Or it could be completely opposite. And look, I think it's open for discussion. I want to hear everyone's feedbacks afterward, but I'm just going to give mine now. Macca, give it to me.
Yeah, I'm going from the most sort of, you know, that had the biggest impact on me. And this could be from when I was a kid up until now. You know, I think it's fair to say all your inspiration comes as a kid. For the people who don't know, I started racing when I was seven. So. It's a long time. I'm not going to say how old I am. You can look that up. But number one for me, right was in the prime of my sort of young teenage years. Two words, King Kelly.
Oh.
King Kelly, he'd won it in 86. Sean Kelly had won it in 86 amongst his plethora of other victories. However, that's not the one I'm talking about. It was the one in 1992.
Tell us about it.
At age 36, and this is one of the most legendary victories, I think, of Milan-San Remo. It is. For me, it is the most legendary victories because Kelly goes across the top. He's riding four Festina watches. Yeah. He's 36 years of age. In 1992, 36, you were like a grandpa. They didn't race that old. They didn't race.
I didn't even know he rode on Festina.
Yes, right at the end of his career, and he had this big shell helmet on, which – you know, they were still using, you know, the soft footy helmets back then. So he goes across the top of the Poggio, and Moreno Argentin, the legendary Italian, is off the front. He's already on the descent. Argentin's gone, out of sight, smoke. He's down the descent. And it's like, well, it's over. They're racing for second. Mm. And there's Rolf Sorensen. There's all these guys. And just a notable mention, Scott Sunderland, Australian, was also in that group.
In the front group.
So Kelly, front group. So Kelly, in his head, says, I don't think so. So he hits the descent, descends like a maniac. He's 36 years of age. He goes around these corners on rails. He catches Argentin as they pass under the 1 kilometre to go. Argentin flicks the elbow and Kelly's just like, forget about it, pal. Forget it, forget it, forget it. Argentin was pretty quick in his day, but as we know, Kelly was a sprinter. He could do anything, you know, back in that era, that's sort of what they were. But Kelly really was a sprinter. And let's remind everyone, Italian racing in that era, the Italians ruled the roost, and the mafia ruled the roost, and the fans ruled the roost. You didn't mess with the Italians on their home turf, especially
San Remo.
In a race like exactly. So Kelly just absolutely smokes Argentin in the kick. Completely destroys him, wins, and then the group comes in, sprints for, you know, third place. Argentin was, you know, obviously devastated. But for me, it's not so much the victory. Well, it is the victory of Kelly, but the descent. At age 36, he was at the end of his career. Mm. I think he only raced maybe one more year, maybe two, but he should never have won it. He was not going to win that day. And you can, and if you don't believe me, get on YouTube, peeps, because it's there. You can see it. And someone's, digitized it, made it the picture quality better, you know, from VHS to whatever the next level is.
You're so thankful
but
for
that.
That
is my number one.
Yeah.
Oh, I know. I couldn't be bothered doing the time. Plus, I don't know how to do it. But thank you to the people who do that, who remastered. That's it. It's remastered and it is on YouTube. That is my number one.
Wow. It's a big one. I can't even argue with that. I haven't seen it, but you built the story up for me. I like it. I like the end of his career, but I also like the way that he went about it. Didn't wait for the sprint. Didn't wait to sprint for second. Went on the hunt.
Yeah, on the hunt.
That's the thing with it, isn't it? So I guess it's up to me now to rebut, is it?
Yeah, it is. Yes, please. Your rebuttal.
Well, I didn't have any specific order, but I'm going to have to bring one of my big guns. And seeing as you mentioned the Italian sort of nostalgia about it, I'm going to throw him straight out there, the shark, Vincenzo Nibali.
Yeah.
Let's talk about it.
Brilliant. It was you know what? He was hovering around, and I won't disclose if he's still going to make a mention, but yeah, I'm glad you mentioned him. Yeah, it was a good one.
So it's 2018. It's not even that long ago. And Nibali, it's that race that he was always sort of wanting on his palmares. But as we said already, it's the Sprinter's Classic.
He was up against him. It's probably the hardest one to win for him.
The thing is, they went into the Poggio. Mohoric does the big lead out at the bottom. And the next thing you know, straight over the top, you've got the rider. I've forgotten his name now off the top of my head, but he just attacks. Nibali just sort of snakes off. He goes from there. He counters straight over the top. But as everyone knows, Nibali is known for his descending. And since then, Mohoric has smashed his time, but it's arguable because Mohoric, you know, he was on the back of the motorbike. He's got the dropper post. The way Vincenzo descends down there, it's unbelievable. You've got Trentin behind. Yeah. He attacks at the bottom to try and get across. He solos away for it. For me, at the end of his career, it was the thing that Nibali was missing. He's such an all-round rider with the Tour de France win, the Giro. He has now the monument, the Italian classic, you know, of course, Lombardia. But to win this, you know, as we just said then, I think it's harder for a climber to win this.
Yeah, and I've always found him one of those deceiving riders. He never looks like he's flying.
Mm.
Like, he never looks like he's flying. Even in Milan-San Remo, he's somehow descending away from them. Sure, he looks quick. Anyone looks quick going downhill. But when he comes off the descent, it's like he's riding into the finish and it's like, no, they're going to catch him. He's actually not going that fast. And he holds off this, you know, angry peloton, because it was actually a pretty big group that came in, I think, and sprinted for second. So, no, that is up there. And as you would well know, you cannot afford to make one little error on that descent. And riders have made errors before, and that's it, game over, race over.
Well, second was Caleb Ewan, you know, the Australian.
Yes.
And he was so disappointed. He was coming home. Nibali does the two-arm salute, the look back. He knew he had it. The best way you could ever hope to win your own race, you know, the Italian classic, just looking back going, I've got it. No one gets to do that.
No. That's a good one. I'll give you that one.
All right.
You know, and look, we come from a different vintage. So you were probably in nappies, not even when King Cully won in 92. So, you know, you wouldn't even remember.
All right. Who else you got then?
Okay. Number two, actually two and three here. These are, look, they had to be done from me. And I think you'll understand this. Number two is Matt Goss.
Oh, I knew you were going to do it.
Goss's victory in 2011. And look, it was a bit of a roll of the toss of the coin between, and I'll give you three as well, Guerin. So I might couple them together, the two Aussies, because Goss was the first Australian, you know. And I love history. I love history being made by Aussies at, you know, big races, of course, you know, Cadell winning the Tour. We all felt like it was Christmas, I think. But Gossi winning in 2011, you know, you raced with him. He's more your era. And, you know, I sort of saw you young guys coming up as I was retiring. But Gossi was always this sort of grunty sort of bike rider, you know. He never looked beautiful on a bike. Mm. He never looked, you know, smooth as silk or anything like that. But Chizzy had some grunt. what you saw was what you got for Matt Goss. And to win in 2011, he just muscled his way into that victory. It was
brilliant. You got to look at the guys he beat there too. Fabian, Gilbert, Bolan, Pizzardo, yep. Scarponi. It was a small group. They'd sort of separated on the bottom of the Poggio there. And no one was looking at him. Maybe that was the best part for him, but he was so explosive in those days.
Oh, yeah. It was, you know, and I don't think there's too many riders and even people in his career and post-career. And I know we say this about people, you know, when they've retired or whatever, but Gossie to me is such a likable person because he's so grounded. You know, he's a good Tassie boy, isn't he, from Launceston. And, you know, it was like easy come, easy go. It's like, man, you've just won a monument. You have just won a monument. Do you know what you've done? He's like, yeah, cool. Yeah, it was great, whatever. And then Gerrans's victory, the difference about Simon, did you race that
I
one?
I didn't race it, no.
Not the 2012 one. So 2011 Goss. So then we backed it up. Two Aussies in a race. And sorry, I'm jumping ahead here to three.
Yeah,
so
right. I'll let you couple them together.
The brilliant part about Simon's victory was he had to hold something like, he had to accelerate 2,000 watts out of each hairpin to hang on to Fabian's wheel for one. And then he was as cold as ice. He just would not give him a turn coming into the finish because he knew if he did, Cancellara was probably going to tear his legs off. So he was as cold as ice and he was able to max out to 2,000 watts out of each corner off the Poggio, and then he won. So
what about
2011, 2012?
What about Fabs? 2011 second, 2012 second. How much does that hurt?
He blew. To me, he massively blew 2012.
Yeah.
I mean, Gero was cold as ice. And if you have three guys being as cold as ice, because I think it was Nibbly there, well, they would have got caught. To me, Cancellara, absolutely, he just rode it into the finish line and still thought he'd outsprint them. I think he thought he was stronger.
That's what
than
I'm saying.
Was.
Is it just too much? I think it was just too much confidence. He's coming out of that season, Leopard, and that period. He was coming out of CSC, whereas, you know, everyone's questioning the motor and all that sort of stuff because he was riding like a motor, you know, up the Mur to Gerritsbergen and then across, you know, Carrefour to Larborough and dropping Boonen and dropping the best. So he's probably like, you know what, Gerrans, I'll just get rid of this guy. It's only, you know, it's only the sprinter's race. This guy's going to get pumped.
Yeah, he's where's he from, Mansfield? Like, jeepers, seriously. Where even is that? He was saying to himself.
And, you know, I think something that needs to be brought into that is it's the first year of Green Edge, you know, the start of a team and the pressure's building. Gerrans saved the day at the Australian Championships. He essentially saves the day again with that win. I'm not saying the team was sort of in trouble then, but that allowed the team to relax a bit. It's like, hey, we've just won a monument in our first year.
And I was going to say, and actually we talked about this just the other night in the commentary, Matty Keenan and I, it's like teams go a whole career and don't win a monument. Teams go a whole career and don't win a stage at the Tour de France. And suddenly, you know, in their first year of existence, Green Edge go, oh, yeah, monument, one, down, done, tick, box ticked, onto the next one. Like, it was incredible, really.
And you got to remember that, like, how valuable a rider he was with that. You know, I wonder when you say that now, Gossie came into the team, and we're drifting off the topic now, previous winner, and then, you know, Gerrans sort of surpasses that. Was there any, do you reckon there's anything with that, or is this sort of like, great, you know, I'm sort of happy that my teammate won?
Oh, come on, mate, you're closer to that bubble than I am.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I think you know, Gossie's career peaked early and dropped off, you know, I guess quicker. So he, you know, he retired sort of younger, didn't he, than someone like Simon Gerrans. And you know, Gero's victory, that was the start of his sort of, you know, beautiful period as an athlete, wasn't it? Where he just, you know, he went on to win Liège, he wore the yellow on stages of the tour. Like he was, I think there was a period there where he was ranked number one in the world, you know, and those two monuments that he did win, he beats Valverde in one at Liège and he beats Cancellara, two of the best in the world at the time.
I'm going to try and, seeing as we're talking about this era, I'm going to slot one in.
Okay.
Mark Cavendish, 2009, in the 100th edition of San Remo, his first attempt wins San Remo, and in an epic edition, Hausler second, Hushoff third.
And poor old Hausler, he's knocked on the door a bunch of times, knocked on the door at Flanders, knocked on the door here, and it almost goes unnoticed. So I'm glad you sort of throw that in. I mean, that's almost like arsy, isn't it? If it wasn't Mark Cavendish, I'd say it was arsy, but it's like a little bit greedy. Your first attempt at a monument and you just knock it over and go, thank you very much.
Well, I guess why I want to bring it back, why are these rides influential, most influential riders for San Remo? I think, you know, when I think back at Gossie, first Australian, it's always good for the first countryman to win it. I want to go back to Nibali and be like the Italian sort of, they loved him, you know, the Italian climber. He was so influential for the race. Cavendish, I think, became more influential with his career later on. If Cavendish had sort of won a handful of races and retired, whatever, I would have never brought that up. But the fact that in the 100th edition, it's sort of got a nice ring to it. And then he has still going, this amazing career going, that's really makes it really influential for me, because otherwise, yeah, it's just another winner, another great sort of win, and, you know, the house is second and that sort of thing. So I think that's sort of where it's giving the weight for me. The victory itself, I rewatched it to see. It's hard to actually tell what Cav's ride was throughout the day, apart from the final sprint. But I think it's got more to do with what's happened with Cav after his career, why that's become influential.
Yeah, and I think he sort of tries to play it down, and, you know, it's like this going for the outright, you know, record of Tour de France stage wins. He totally wants it.
Mm.
He's only kept going for another year because he wants that. He loves sort of historical moments. So I agree with you. It's great. But it's also something that I think he'll cherish when he's done and dusted. When his career is finally over, he'll say, wow, I won Milan-San Remo, 100th edition, and it was my first attempt. That was the type of athlete I was. You know, and he's allowed to say that because he is an amazing athlete.
Try and win it now. You know, just trying to tick it off now. How hard would that be? San Remo. Oh, it's the only thing I'm missing.
And isn't it crazy how, I mean, he's probably ridden San Remo at least half a dozen times, I suppose. He's only won it once, correct? Mm. Is that right? He's won it once, which was his first attempt. Like, it just shows how hard it is to win. And sometimes, even in that first edition, of course, they're the best on the day, but you need a little bit. You just need everything to go right, don't you? And sometimes it happens like that. And then sometimes you go a whole career, like, you know, poor old Matty Heyman had to get bruised and battered for about 15 years before he won Paris-Roubaix. Poor bugger. You know, he got there, but geez, what an apprenticeship he had to do.
Well, the thing is too, you think of a guy like Gilbert, he was trying to just tick that last monument off to get the five. He just couldn't get it. He was so close so many times.
Yeah.
That's what makes this race so hard. I'm not saying any other monument is easy to win, but it's got something special about it, isn't it?
Yeah, because you can argue, and I'll actually go against this in a second with my next pick, or it's in a few picks, but you can argue it's harder to win than something like Liège, because depending on the rider, right? Because it's a sprinter's race, but then it's not really. A GC guy can win it. A Rouleur can win it, and the first 250 kilometers doesn't really matter.
So,
but you've got to survive the first 250 to be in the mix for the win.
That's right, because everyone's still there. So, like, you talk about a race like Flanders, Roubaix, Liège. There's so much going on in the early part of the race that it just eliminates a lot of riders. I'm not saying the best riders aren't there, but a lot of guys who are sort of on the cusp of maybes and whatever. But you can't say maybes are winning San Remo. There isn't something. But give us your next one. Go on.
All right, so this next one, I'm throwing a curly here. We've talked about victories pretty much so far. This one just sticks in my head. It's for whatever reason, when I think about Milan-San Remo, and it's weird how these moments, you remember, I'm calling it the long arm.
Oh, here we go. Damar, you're saying Damar.
The long arm, 2016. Damar wins the race. He wins the race. I had to go back. I looked at vision. Couldn't see any vision. I think Damar he's got like half a dozen tech people in a room deleting vision still off YouTube, apparently, allegedly. So Damar wins. And then of all the nations, right, it was two Italians who basically dobbed him in and said, I saw him taking a sling off his own team car. But I think they said he was taking the sling on the descent, not on the climb. It was actually on the descent or across the top. He was off the back and he was trying to, you know, rejoin. And so there was a couple of riders, there was at least two, maybe a few more. But, you know, they had no vision. They had two riders' word. But it was all done and dusted. By then, DeMar's popping the champagne. So that was it. He'd won.
In case anyone doesn't know the story, set it up. It's allegedly that he got towed up. His Strava time is the fastest time up the Poggio. Never can be touched.
Well, he's since deleted, apparently, his Strava from that day. So this is what? So it's 2016. We're going back, what, 8 years ago, 9 years ago almost. So, but that's right. He allegedly took a tow from his own team car. No vision. There's a photo, I think. I think there is a photo somewhere. And he wins the race. There was a nasty crash. A crash in the last 300 metres. I think it was the Colombian sprinter who was looking like, you know, the commentators were talking
about. What, Gaviria?
He was going to win. Gaviria. It was Gaviria, I think. Yeah, he crashes in that last little chink in the road, sort of 300 metres out. And DeMar just sort of slots off the wheel, wins the bike race, and then, you know.
Takes the com up Poggio as well.
Yeah, all this innuendo comes out later. But for whatever reason, that just sticks in my head when I talk about moments of Milan-San Remo. That's one of them.
So, wait, how many have you got now? You've named Gossi, Gero, DeMar,
and
Kelly.
Yeah, four.
Right. Yeah. I've named Nibali, Cavendish, and you stole my Gossi. He was my number one.
Oh, I stole your Gossi. Okay.
So yeah. I'm going to slot in with a real epic rider, four-time winner, Eric Zabel. But I'm not slotting him in for his victory. I'm slotting Zabel in for his 2004 edition when he's beaten by Oscar Freire. He's beaten by 3 centimetres as he salutes for his fifth win.
He's putting the arms up.
He's won in 97. He's won in 98. He comes back in 2000. He wins. He wins again in 2001. 2004, he's like, boom, I've got it 5 times. Ferrer sneaks underneath him and takes the victory. Can you imagine? I remember as a young cyclist, as I came through, seeing that photo and getting told, don't do an Eric Zabel, you sprint to the line and you don't salute until you're across the line. Can you imagine losing San Remo?
Yeah, he's in, and unfortunately for Zabel, he's in our coaching textbooks around the world. You know, that's what not to do.
He's,
you know, clause number 6.4, the Eric Zabel, you know, it's sort of like the Stephen Bradbury, but the opposite. Don't do that. And I was about to say everyone's done it once. I can say it never happened to me, but we do, I'm sure between us, we know a bunch of riders in smaller races and mid-sized races, but a monument of all the bike races. I mean, it's actually insane, isn't it? And I think fair to say, because it was close. It was, as you said, it was like a couple of inches, two or three inches. He would have won if he hadn't have thrown his arms in the air. If he had just waited even half a bike length later, he would have won the race. It's pretty almost a guarantee.
He's second in 2009 and second in 2004, potentially a six-time winner. Can that lead me into my next choice?
Yes, yeah.
Because
I think
doubled up. Let me double up.
I did.
This is my number five. I can't go past him. I hope I haven't stolen it from you. 7-time winner, Eddie Merckx. I couldn't pick an edition. I don't know all of his editions. I just had to make mention of the great, the cannibal. Yep. The guy who's only won. Guy's won 5 of the monuments, 7 times San Remo.
You haven't stolen it. And so I'm glad you picked it though, because it's a tough one. And you're right. It's actually all about the number. On the same. It's like, I'd have to go back and look at them, but there's probably not vision of all of them, you know, somewhere on the internet. But it is literally about the 7. Like, it's phenomenal to win 7. It is hands down. Hands down, he is, to me, still one of the greatest. And, you know, eras are different, et cetera. It was European racing. It wasn't global cycling then. We didn't have all of the other nationalities that were, you know, flooding into Europe. But it doesn't matter. It was what it was. And to win seven, you know, not even have a bad day, you know, of those seven. You know, not be sick, not be this, not be that. Or maybe he was. Maybe he was crook on a couple of them and he still won. I mean, that's how good he was.
I'd argue now, thinking about San Remo and talking about Zabel and also Oscar Ferrer, who also won three editions himself, it is actually, if we have to pick a rider that it suits the most, it's actually that style of rider, that sprinter who can just get over one more, you know?
Yeah, not quite a purist.
Yeah, like so going back, Gero sort of randomly suited the race. He had a kick, maybe not as much as those guys, but he was never going to get dropped on the Poggio.
I mean, it just shows, digressing, Gero's versatility too. Like he wins arguably, I'm saying, hope in quotation, the easiest monuments, which we've already established it's not. Mm. But in terms of terrain, Milan-San Remo goes to arguably the hardest in terms of terrain, Liège, and wins that as well. Like that's... You know, that's other end of the scale in terms of the monuments. You know, the other three are different in their own right. But, yeah, it just shows, again, the nuances of Milan-San Remo. But, I think it's evolving and changing too over the generations now, and that's why we see these little different winners. And possibly now is the most exciting period because it still throws it up that a Grand Tour winner, like a Tour de France winner, can win Milan-San Remo. And on the same year, a Mark Cavendish or a sprinter, Caleb Ewan, can also win it. That's what's good about it.
Give it to me. Give me your number five.
Okay, I've got another doozy.
Have you got a nickname?
And it's not. So this guy won the race.
What's your number six going to be then? If these are your doozies.
The six is a good one. The six is a tribute one. Yep. But this is a doozy. So he won the race. I can't even tell you when he won it. I don't care because. All I know is Little Onions threw his bike through the back of the car in 1992. Mario Cipollini.
I was going to pick him. Onions. God, yeah.
Yeah, Mario Cipollini. 1992. I swear to God, when you sort of told me the premise of this discussion, I searched the web far and wide last night and I'm like, hang on a minute, did I dream this? Did this actually not happen? Finally, I found one photo
of him.
Of Cipollini's bike. It was back in like the race director's car. So the car has gone across the line. They're obviously not sprinting in for the win because if Cipo had a won or if it had been a sprint, he probably would have won even in 1992. So he cracks the shits and because the cars literally gets jammed across the finish line. And back then there wasn't the OH&S and regulations that now we have. The car just stopped like 50 metres, 40 metres after the line. Cipo gets off his bike and plants it through the back windscreen of the car and the bike is literally in the car, like completely smashed the windscreen. I don't even know if he copped a fine.
No, he wouldn't have.
Like in 92.
It's in San Remo. Why would he?
It's in San Remo. The mafiosa and the tifosi were just like, it's fine, mate. Yep. Can you just extract your bike from the race director's car and off you go. So that's mine, 1992. Remember that?
Well, 2002 was the year that he won it. I've just quickly looked up while you were talking. Not that I knew it off the top of my head. I should have. And while I was looking it up, I've noticed that, I'll go back on this, the Italian legend of a climber, Chiappucci took it out in 91.
Yes.
I would love to go back and look at that edition. Oh, I was talking about Nibali. Yeah. He is the, the Nibali of the early,
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Chiappucci was amazing because his shot to fame was in the 1990 Tour de France, in my opinion. He was sort of a nobody. He went in a breakaway in the first week of the tour. These things happened back then, Brakes went and took 15 minutes. He went in a break with Ronan Pensec, I think it was, and they took 10 or 12 minutes. All of the other GC guys missed it or weren't in it. So it was a bit of a,
Whatever
sort of a break. Pensec takes the yellow. He's on the same team as Greg LeMond. Meanwhile, they don't know that this little Italian can actually climb.
Oh, yeah.
And then he ends up finishing second in the Tour de France that year. LeMond only catches him, passes him to take the yellow, I think on the third last stage, an individual TT. And that's when he pulls back all the time on Chiappucci. But it took him the whole 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks to do it. And then, 2 years later, 91 did you say?
91.
91, he wins Milan-San Remo. But he shot to fame in that edition of the Tour de France 1990. And then, man, did the Italian fans go crazy, because he was a superstar. He really was. And he was that sort of rider. He was class. But he'd say, okay, I'm attacking early. And I think that's how he won that Milan-San Remo edition.
Mm.
You know, it wasn't on the last two climbs. He actually attacked a long, long way
out. I'm super disappointed that I never really picked up on that in our research, but he is going to give me a notable mention in the top seven.
Yeah.
I'm going to go for it. I'm going to go for my questionable top six. My questionable is a guy you've mentioned, Heinrich Hausler. And for good reason, he does the lead out. He's actually doing, if you watch this again, he's doing the lead out for Tor Hushov. They're riding for Cervelo Test Team. It's in the first year of Cervelo Test Team, 2009, and he does the lead out. This team was absolutely flying that year. I was in Qatar when they were just taking the absolute piss there. I was there racing, just getting my ass kicked, and they were finishing 1, 2, 3. No one's doing that in Qatar. They hit San Remo. They get second and third. Hausler does this lead out that blows everyone away, and it takes Cavendish just to crawl over him.
Oh, yes.
And that's when Hushov just rolls in for third. That sets up what an unbelievable season, not only for the team, but for Hausler. It kickstarts his career again. He starts off as a young pro in Gerolsteiner. He sort of hovers around for a bit, but then we see the best of Hausler after that. Amazing classic season. As you mentioned, second at Flanders, fourth at Dwars of Flandre, and top 10 at Roubaix. Later on that year, he wins a stage at the Tour. And we forever remember Hausler after that year. Whether he ever was better than that or not, he was just set again in our minds. And I think that's what makes, for me, San Remo so good, the most sort of undoubtable. And this is the questionable one that sort of resonates with me.
And you know, we can, you know, you hate to say this, but hey, was it a sliding door moment? And, you know, I hate hindsight, but I'm going to go with it just because why not? You know, what if on that day they had to turn the tables and said, Hushov had said, you know what, mate, you are flying. I'll lead you out.
Mm.
Would we be sitting here now saying about the, you know, the first Australian? No, or the third Australian to win it?
I don't know. I don't know if it would have, because the lead out maybe had a different mentality. I'm just going to hit out. Yeah. I'm just going to do my job for a teammate. And that's a different, as you know, that's a different mentality than if you're waiting on a wheel for the win, you feel the pressure the whole day. He just was free-spirited going for it.
Yeah.
And he just got that gap. And if you watch the sprint again, you're like, Heino, sprint in a straight line, buddy. He's going left, he's going right.
Yes. So, and Cav still only just got over him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so.
It leaves it with you, buddy.
Number six, right? I've actually got two more, but I've got six and then I've got an honourable mention I just feel like this honourable mention.
I gave Kipuchi as my honourable. Let's add that in.
Yeah, okay. Okay. So number six, and in my research, because I was lacking a couple, and in my research, this one kept popping up. And, you know, YouTube, Google, and I was like, And in the end, I saw a video, a clip of it. So I watched it. And it's actually legendary. And I said to my mate, and I know he's a good friend of yours, Matt Cannon, I said, I really should have raced in the 80s. I was the type of guy, you know, I was pretty good as a cyclist. Yeah, sure, I won a Giro stage. But I went in a long break solo and no one chased me. They let me go. You know, that was like an 80s sort of victory. And I was that type of rider. I was an opportunist. So this guy is my number six, and I tip my hat to him. The year is 1982.
Okay.
His name is Marc Gomez. He's French. He's not Spanish. His parents were Spanish, but he's French. Marc Gomez, 1982. He is approximately 10 days into his professional career.
Oh!
He's just turned professional.
Neo! Right?
10 days. He's Neo. He's still in nappies.
I can't believe it.
He's got the nappies on at the start line.
EB.
They go down the road and bang, breakaway goes within the first 20-odd kilometres. 20 kilometres into 290, 20-odd riders go up the road. Anyway, it dwindles down. They get down to the last two climbs and he's with another Frenchman compatriot, Alain Bondu, who was actually quite a good cyclist. I think he rode for Renault at that time. So there's two of them left, and On paper, you would have said Bondu was going to win. If it came to a sprint finish, and even on the climb, Bondu would drop him or out-sprint him either way. But wow, what a great performance by this Mark Gomez. However, Bondu somehow, there's only two of them left, he somehow manages to crash on one of the descents, takes himself out. Gomez then rides solo up the final climb, down the descent, into the finish, and wins by about 2 minutes.
Did he crash on the Chipressa?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, crashed on the Chipressa. So Gomez rides the final climb, descends.
2 minutes.
Keeps it upright.
He would have just cruised down the Poggio. Loved it.
And by the way, in my research, I could be wrong here, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. I haven't got it in front of me, but Marino Argentino, old mate Marino Argentino, who got done over by Kelly in 92, he finished third.
Oh, no.
In 82. So all these guys, and I think Moser was there as well. So this Gomez, he was a nothing. He was 10 days into his pro career. But when you dig a little bit deeper, he actually went on to win three stages of the Vuelta. He won the French National Championship. So this guy was obviously good. You know, he obviously had some talent. But that is my sort of tip.
Very good.
If I was ever going to win Milan-San Remo, I can tell you now, I wouldn't be sitting back waiting. I'd be doing the long breakaway.
Wow, so the most influential. He could have made the top five, I reckon. He doesn't even need to be in sixth.
Yeah. Now, do you have another honourable mention?
I don't have another one. I'm happy to leave it there. I'll listen to yours. Claudio, I'm happy. He was my honourable mention.
Yeah, Claudio's. Yeah, that was a good one. Carrera jeans, you know, the Knicks. So my honourable mention, and this is sort of, it has to be because he's remembered for everything else in some ways, and especially in this particular year, right? The year is 1989. The year is 1989, and it is a Frenchman, Laurent Fignon.
Who wins
his second consecutive Milan-San Remo. He won it in 88. He wins it in 89. He goes on to win the Giro d'Italia, but then he finishes second in the Tour de France by 8 seconds to Greg LeMond.
89, of
the
course.
Most famous. To me, still the most famous finish of the Tour de France. The only, they finished with an individual TT up and down the Champs-Élysées in 89. And Fignon was a Parisian, you know, that was his hometown. So he's remembered for that 8 second loss. But that year for Laurent Fignon was
amazing,
phenomenal. Wins the Giro, wins Milan-San Remo. He won about half a dozen other bike races that year. But he's remembered for that Tour de France loss or second place, if you like. But his 89 victory, solo victory again. And not too many, if you go back through the history books, there are not too many that went back to back. He's one of them. And, you know, rest in peace, what a legend he was.
The most influential, I think we've wrapped it up because it's people who use this race, impact on us. And I think that's what you explained, perfect last one. San Remo sets you up for a good season. It sets you up. I mentioned with Hauser, it's a great card. If you're looking for tips for the year, who's going to be going good, look no further than San Remo because it is producing everyone. It's producing all kinds of riders, Tour de France winners, Cobble Classics, you know, contenders. I'm looking forward to it. I've really enjoyed the new format. Macca, what do you think?
Oh, yeah, I love this, mate. This is good. It's good research too. It's actually I love looking back. And I don't know about you, but my, you know, it sort of shows a little bit of the ones I picked. It's all from my sort of formative years, my mostly teenage years. You know, they're my heroes. The riders now, you know, they're champions. I love covering them as a journalist and commentator. But really, my heroes are from the sort of 80s and very early 90s. But yeah. It's coming. It's this weekend. Oh, I love it. The first monument of the year. Can't wait.
And that's why we did it. Macca, loved it. Thanks for being on.
Thank you, mate. Cheers.
Well, what did you think? Send in your letters. I love to hear what you think. Who do you think should have made the top 6? Who should have made the top 5, more like it? because this is going to be a discussion point, and we're going to continue in this way for Talking Law for a few more episodes this year. I really like this idea. I really like sort of unpacking who thinks they should make the top five or the top six, you know, throw in a roughie as well. It's fun. I really like this new direction, and I'm having a little bit of fun with it. Let me know what you guys think. A big thanks to our partners in the podcast map, of course, Red Bricks Media, who helped put this episode together as well, and the Life in the Peloton team behind the scenes to help you bring everything that you see and hear with Life in the Peloton. Guys, it's happening. A massive episode next week. Massive. Tom Boonen. He is going to be on Life in the Peloton next week. Hang in. That is coming straight for you. I say no more. Guys, until next week, thanks for listening. That iconic music in this episode was composed by none other than the legend, Pete Shelley. Cheers, mate.